One of the pleasures of visiting cities we don't live in is getting to see the sights and get a feel for neighborhoods and architecture and food and more. We can cover a lot of ground on wheels, but we notice the finer details on foot. In the age of the car, though, cities are not necessarily geared to walkers. Our next guest wants to change that. Jeff Speck is an urban planner based in the Boston area. He's the author of a book called Walkable City and published a few years ago. Jeff also delivers TED Talks and travels to cities to present his visions. He'll be in Eugene tomorrow at 5:30 at the Hult Center Studio to present a talk called Toward a More Walkable Eugene. Jeff Speck, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thanks for having me. I guess it's Jeff and Jeff on Jeff.
Oh, that's right, Jeff. That's right. The program is called Jeff, and so is the network as well. So, yes, it's a plethora of Jeffs. It's the grand slam of Jeffs. Sorry about the Red Sox this year, by the way.
That's okay.
When Grand Slam came up, I had to go there. Anyway, walkable cities. Was this something that became a burning desire of yours to see us get to this point or return to this point from years back?
You know, I'm a city planner trained as an architect who's just been interested in great city planning for his whole career. And I joined a movement that was pretty well underway when I started working in it full-time in 1993. That at that point, I believe, was called New Urbanism and still is. But it's essentially an effort that it formed most dramatically around 1980, but it's basically been an effort to propose alternatives to suburban sprawl, understanding that we, for millennia, have built beautiful places in this world, and we kind of stopped doing that around 1950, and that there was a traditional model that served us better than this auto-oriented model. That started with the creation of new towns that were mixed-use and walkable, and eventually became applied to our existing cities when we realized that we were ruining them by redesigning these traditional walkable places around the car. And only recently, and I would say very effectively, has it become renamed the Walkable Cities Movement, because I think that's a much easier concept to get your head around than New Urbanism or some of the other things that we've called it in the past.
Sounds less lofty and actually corresponds to a verb that people can identify with.
Well, first we called it neo-traditional town planning, which turned off the liberals.
Uh-huh.
Then we called it New Urbanism, which turned off the conservatives. And it's really all just good urban design. And when we realized that good urban design, everything we were doing to make places better was just making them more accessible to walking and biking, we realized, hey, let's just call this something that really explains it in a much better way. And it was kind of, no, I wouldn't say an accident, but a bit of a random choice that at that time, 2.5 years ago, I called my book Walkable City, but I'm sure glad I did, because it's really attracted a tremendous audience because of that title, and hopefully because of what's in it. But it allows people to really understand what matters in cities, which is, sure, we want to be able to drive, but the car should really be an instrument of freedom and not a prosthetic device that you need to accomplish every single one of your daily needs.
So is there a mixture of appropriate places for cars? I mean, we don't really think about cities in terms of like parking cars at the edge and taking mass transportation in, do we?
Only in the most dense and, economically successful cities in which the car, taking the car in becomes either a great nuisance or a great expense or both. In most cities, though, in the typical American city, the car is still the lifeblood of that city, moving people around to places they need to go. But I like to say, it works well when it's moving slowly, and it works badly when, in terms of creating a positive environment around the vehicle. The main problem is that the design of highways has been applied to the design of cities. And so it's one thing to invite the car into the city and to manage it in reasonable ways. It's another thing to apply the same principles which we use to design high-speed highways to the design of city streets, and that's what we've seen throughout the country and also in places like Eugene.
Jeff Speck is an urban planner, the author of Walkable City. He'll be talking in Eugene tomorrow at 5:30 at the Hult Center Studio on Toward a More Walkable Eugene. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. That last thing it says is really intriguing, that we've designed cities like we're designing highways. In what? Give us some examples.
Well, the AASHTO manual, which is the green book that all engineers use to design streets, is a highway manual. And most engineers were trained on highways. And in fact, the discipline of transportation engineering, or should say traffic engineering, began as highway engineering and then was later applied to our existing downtown cores without anyone thinking about the rules that led up to it. And it's very interesting because what makes highways safer is exactly what makes cities more dangerous. This will hopefully be the only long thought I lay on you this morning.
That's okay.
But when you're designing a highway, think about it this way. When you're going to drive on a highway, what determines your speed? If you're like me, you look at the speed limit, and then you set your cruise control for 9 miles an hour over the speed limit, right? You know that the environment is designed to accept that sort of speed. And as a transportation engineer, you design the highway around a presumed speed. So everything you do that makes it easier to go that speed, wider lanes, no trees, you know, no parallel parking, one-way streets, all those sort of things makes the highway safer. However, what the engineers never realized is that in cities, when you're driving in places where there are shops and people and, you know, homes, you don't set your speed based on the speed limit. You set your speed based on how safe you feel. And in fact, the number one way to control speed is to limit speeding in cities is to create friction. Friction is caused by cars coming the other way on two-way streets. It's caused by parallel parking. It's caused by narrower lanes. It's caused by street trees. All these things make streets safer. And yet engineers have been fighting against them in cities for decades. So that's changing. There are a lot of heroes in the profession who are now understanding that cities need to be designed much better. My visit here to Oregon is sponsored by ODOT. That's never happened before.
Wow.
That a state DOT is bringing me to a place, I should say, in most states, and to a certain degree still in Oregon, the DOT is the enemy of safety and comfort and downtown success because, for example, they want 12-foot driving lanes on their streets, which should be 10-foot driving lanes and used to be 10-foot driving lanes.
So the idea being that they want to get the traffic through an area fast, you're talking about making it slow down so it can enjoy the area while it's there.
Exactly, ignoring the fact that studies show that a 12-foot lane carries no more vehicles per hour than a 10-foot lane. So there's all this data now that proves There's all this data now that proves that 10-foot lanes are safer, like life-saving, compared to 12-foot lanes, yet most DOTs have not adjusted, and like almost no DOTs have adjusted their standards to reflect that.
This must be a tricky line to hit for an urban planner trying to advise the people making the streets, though, because you're trying to make this friction that you're talking about so that people do slow down, but at the same time not get people so frustrated, I would think, that they never want to drive there and go through there.
Well, when I was saying slowing down, I was thinking to myself, I need to explain what I mean by that. And I don't mean making it necessarily take much longer to get through a place. I just mean, you know, if you have a marked speed limit of 25 or 30, let's have people going 25 or 30 and not going 40 or 45. Your chances of being killed when hit by a car at 35 are 8 times what they are if you're hit at 25. And so that threshold is super important, and it's precisely the threshold that, for example, a 12-foot versus a 10-foot lane controls. So the great thing is I have the data, you know. I've not been to Eugene yet. I've met your mayor and worked with Kitty Piercy at a Mayor's Institute, which is a program I used to oversee a number of years ago when I was design director at the National Endowment for the Arts, and was very impressed by her, and she brought a case study from Eugene that we all looked at. So I got to know your city a little bit. I see you still haven't gotten rid of your one-way pairs, which many cities are getting rid of. And I can tell you, you know, in Louisville, they had 4 streets that were one-way. Well, they have many more, but 4 of them, Brook, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, were all one-way. And they reverted Brook and 1st to two-way, and they kept back to two-way, and they kept 2nd and 3rd as one-way. And on the ones they reverted, car crashes went down 48%, crime went down 23%. On the ones that were kept one-way, car crashes went up 15%, crime went up 36%. So there's all this great data that tells us how cities thrive when streets are designed in certain ways that's only beginning to control the design of our streets and cities.
Well, you know, this makes it even more interesting that ODOT invited you here because we broadcast to several cities on the Oregon side and into California as well. On the Oregon side in particular, there are many cities that have one-way pairs generally built around Oregon 99. You know, the main street, essentially, the old main highway up up the state. And so, essentially, ODOT is bringing in a heretic.
Well, you know, I've been all over the country, and I've been to every state except North Dakota. I'm still waiting for them to invite me. And I was surprised when I drove the Oregon coast from Portland down to, what is it, Wachots?
Yahats.
Yahats. And beyond. I had a wonderful time with my wife who lived here for a while. And I kept coming upon these lovely little towns that had once been really nice to walk around, in which the state DOT had taken the main street and created a one-way pair. So that you essentially, you know, the highway barrels into town, it splits into two streets, one goes north, one goes south, or even east-west, whichever way is oriented, and kind of wrecking the downtown. And it was more clearly applied in Oregon than I've seen almost anywhere else.
Okay, and that was exactly what I was talking about. Jeff Speck is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an urban planner, author of the book Walkable City, a big proponent of walkable cities. We'll be in Eugene at the Holt Center studio tomorrow at 5:30, talking about toward a more walkable Eugene. You can join us right now on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Steve in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Howdy. Back in the 60s, Eugene closed off 1, 2, 3 northwest streets for about 4 blocks, and it pretty much killed downtown because, you know, what works in Southern California and these big pedestrian malls isn't quite so popular out in the cold and the rain during the winter time. And for us, a walkable city was just a disaster, and we finally had to take out the tank tracks built in the middle of Broadway and Willamette and, you know, reintroduce streets just to get people back.
Okay, good point, Steve. Appreciate that. So Jeff, when we talk about making cities walkable, are we necessarily talking about closing off some streets and turning them into pedestrian malls?
Yeah, I'd be disagreeing with the caller if I was an idiot and didn't have data. The fact is that the caller is absolutely right, and one of the things we talk about in the book is how in America about 200 main streets were closed to cars in the 1960s and 1970s. About 150 of them failed immediately. Many of the rest are still on life support. And the only real successes you see are in either university towns like Boulder or Burlington, Vermont. And by the way, it has very little to do with weather. You see it in resort places like 3rd Street, Santa Monica, or South Beach in Miami. But there's a handful of successes. And the successes are successful because the streets essentially function like malls with proper anchors, or they're in student towns where kids are walking anyway. But the main lesson we learned from that was while closing a American street to cars entirely is not a guarantee of failure, the odds of success are so small that you probably shouldn't do it. Many communities now are talking about doing it again because there is this whole walkable movement and people don't understand. Well, I should say people don't look at past successes and failures and learn from them. And we have a lot of people in communities, like the caller, who make statements about what works and what doesn't without having the research. Now, the research shows very clearly, you know, most American stores depend on cars driving by them to succeed. Now, you can test it. And this is the big mistake we made in the 60s and 70s, is that I wasn't involved. I was in you know, elementary school. But we built, you know, on a lark, we built incredibly expensive brick streets full of barriers to keep the cars out. And then when the shops failed, we didn't have the money to unbuild them. So now what I recommend in the communities that I go to is that they actually test it, put in some planters, put some trees in the way on a Saturday afternoon. If it works, expand it to Sunday, and then maybe even make it quote-unquote permanent, but not permanent in a way that you can't fix it easily, because it takes a while to really learn how successful these places are. But, I mean, the point I want to make, I don't mean to be, well, I guess I do mean to be hard on the caller, but my point is that city planning is a profession that's existed now for many years. There's a ton of information about what works and what doesn't. And I go around the country just watching cities stumble into mistakes that we've made over and over again or fail to see opportunities that other cities have grabbed over and over again with clear records of success or failure. And all I'm trying to do is to share those best practices and worst practices so that cities can make good choices.
I saw the list of top 10 most walkable cities that Redfin put out in April with New York, San Francisco, Boston, Philadelphia, Miami, Chicago, Washington, Seattle, Oakland, and Baltimore in that order. Was that a list you were aware of, contributed to?
I'm aware of it. I wasn't involved in it, and I should say it's probably based on WalkScore, which is this wonderful website you should go to, walkscore.com, where you can type in any address or any city and see how walkable it is. I should say, however, having lived in Miami, and Miami's a city that's come a long, long way, that those results tend to be skewed based on the size of the city. If a city's boundaries include its auto-oriented suburbs, it will do less well than if its boundaries don't. And of course, some cities annexed their suburbs and some cities didn't. So Miami is cheating a bit in that roster, because Miami is actually geographically very small, and even though the Miami plus its suburbs can be pretty, you know, hellish, and it's not, I would say, a super walkable city, it does well in that chart because it's only counting the walk scores for within the city limits. I should say, though, with that one exception, you'll notice the cities almost entirely are cities that grew up before the automobile began to dominate our landscape.
Exactly one of my questions. Did they ever get unwalkable in the first place?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's cities in America that were quite walkable that now aren't, and those are pretty easy to fix. And then there's cities in the U.S. that were never walkable. I'm in Tigard this week, and bless their hearts, they have decided, the city council made a proclamation that they are going to be the most walkable community in the Pacific Northwest. But their bones are almost all from 1950. So what do you do? And the fact is, that's most of America that was built post-1950. How do you fix it? And the great thing for Tigard and for other places is that there actually is a little old Main Street that existed before that time that's beginning to come back and that they've invested in already and is looking quite good and can expand. And then there's also the fact that new development is happening, both at the edge of the urban growth boundary, which has been expanded slightly in Portland to allow for more growth, but also kind of gray field areas, you know, dead mall areas, or I should say underutilized industrial areas that are being redeveloped as mixed-use walkable neighborhoods. And with the right plans in place, even these kind of cities can create small areas within them that are eminently walkable. And I made the point last night, which I've made many times, which is that many cities which are known for walkability actually are only walkable in a very small area. But that area is so lovely and so attractive and has enough people in it and shops and other stuff that it develops the reputation for the whole city. And more importantly, it provides the opportunity for those people in the city who want a walking lifestyle to have it.
Jeff Speck is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an urban planner and major proponent of walkable cities. Wolfgang in Sunny Valley emails this. He asks, are humans built for living in cities, or are we really built for tribes and villages? The human psyche is incapable of accommodating the multiplicity of cities. Is there therefore a plausible escape to want to stay in your car and only do a small target area in a given city? This also explains the popularity of malls. Cities are an invention of, you know, the stuff like Rome that eventually crumbled, and in a sense we know why. That from Wolfgang in Sunny Valley. Some observations there.
Well, it's clear that our bodies are adjusting over the millennia to all the different environments that we put ourselves in. We have been living in cities to an increasing degree since about 12,000 years ago when we stopped being nomadic. I would say that the evidence suggests that there is no greater generator, for example, of one thing that came out recently was that cities are the best machines for stopping overpopulation that we've ever invented. It's clear that cities are the best ways we've ever come up with for creating wealth. It's very clear that the denser a city is and the larger a city is, actually, the more wealth each individual creates. Humans are different from animals in that we have language and we have civilization, and I would argue civilization actually needs cities.
I have to wonder about the fluidity of walking. It seems like a negotiable sort of thing. And I say this because I saw a city planning effort in Ashland years ago that laid out the footprint of the Rogue Valley Mall over downtown Ashland and pointed out that people don't mind walking from one end of a mall to another. But walking, say, from the library to the plaza in downtown Ashland was a no-go for most people.
Yeah, people don't like walking from one end of a mall parking lot to another. What you're looking at is considering is the central focus of my work, which is what are the environmental conditions that cause people to make the choice to walk. And so my what I call my general theory of walkability, which is the backbone of my book Walkable City, basically discusses how in order to convince people to make the walk has to simultaneously be four things. It has to be useful, it has to be safe, it has to be comfortable, and it has to be interesting. And if you fail to do any one of those things, you will not attract walking. And in most of America, where most people have cars, and you know you're not paying by a long shot the full cost of driving, so there's every incentive to drive, and the car is sitting there in the driveway between you and everything else, it's very hard to get people to make the choice to take the walk instead of the drive. In order to do that, the walk must be as good as the drive, and that's what we try to offer.
Final question and a quick one. Is pedestrian-friendly the same thing as walkable?
I would say so.
Okay.
We can just say we want walking to be an option. We want to offer the car optional lifestyle, and of course for the 30% of Americans who don't drive, we want to give them a viable existence.
Toward a More Walkable Eugene will be Jeff Speck's presentation tomorrow at 5:30 at the Holt Center studio in Eugene. He's an urban planner based in Boston and the author of Walkable City. Jeff Speck, a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thank you. It was fun for me too.
All right, take care.